Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled around a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. You might be quite surprised today. First of all, I'm here with Charlie. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. The people will be like, right, okay, so we're going early modern. No, we're not. We're not, because we've managed to pull you out of early modern. And actually, we've managed to pull me well away from the 20th century as well, haven't we?
I know. Are you scared?
A little bit. A little bit of a nosebleed going on. Although there's some potential for trashing Mel Gibson later, so we're good.
Yeah, we throw that in just for you, Alex. We've got a fantastic guest today, guys. We're joined today by David Pilling. He's an author and historian who specialises in the Edwardian Wars of the late 13th century. Yes, there were other Edwardian times, and they're much more interesting than the one you're probably thinking of.
Yeah, it probably doesn't involve a sex chair, though, does it?
No.
Well, Sadly not. No.
We'll definitely, if we can bring that into the conversation, I think we will. He's the author of Rebellion Against Henry III and Edward I and Wales, 1254 to 1307. He's here today to talk to us about his newest book, Edward Longshanks, Forgotten Conflict, the Anglo-French War, 1294 to 1303. So we are well out of our comfort zones today, right, Alex. David, thank you so much for dragging us there.
Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at the very officious way that Alina's written this first question, and I just think we can do it better. She's put, what were the origins and causes of the conflict? Which is a really good question, but do you not think we should just kick off with, what did France do this time?
I love that. Okay, so our first question today, David, we think sounds a bit like it comes from a GCSE paper. So instead, I'm going to ask you, the Anglo-French War, David, what did France do this time?
What did France do that? Well, yeah, it's a big question, isn't it? What did France do this time? Well, it's more a question of what did France and England do this time? The origin of the war, that's the focus of the book, the origins of it really sort of depends how far back you want to go. The big marker that I concentrate on is the Treaty of Paris in 1259, whereby Henry III of England essentially renounces his claim to the majority of his lands on the continent. This is what we call the Angevin Empire, which had been constructed by his ancestor in the mid-12th century, Henry II. And the Plantagenet dynasty from about 1154, thanks to a sort of series of marriages and wars, controlled a huge chunk of France, whereas the King of France was restricted to a quite sort of small territory by comparison around Paris. And these lands included Normandy, Brittany, Aquitaine in the southwest, Maine, Anjou, Poitou. It was an enormous cross-channel empire, really. But then King John contrives to lose most of it to the French in the early 13th century, the appropriately named John Lackland. And then his successor, Henry III, he tries to get some of it back via some very unsuccessful military campaigns. And what he does in 1259 is he bows to reality. He's never going to be able to get most of these territories back. So he just signs them away to the King of France, Louis IX, with the exception of the Duchy of Gascony, which is in southwest France. And from 1259 onwards, Henry and his successors are allowed to hold the duchy, but now they hold it as vassals, the King of France, as a fiefdom. So they no longer hold it in their own right. which creates this very awkward and unworkable relationship, because you've got two kings who are equals in that sense. Henry and his successor, Edward I, are kings of England, just as powerful as the King of France. But on the continent, they've got this inferior status. They are dukes of Gascony or Aquitaine. It's got several names, confusingly. And that makes them just one of many nobles or grand seigneurs, magnates of France, entirely under the thumb of the kings of France. And from the start, really, although after 1259, you have this sort of 20, 30 years of sort of an uneasy peace, which is what this treaty is all about. It's meant to stop these endless wars between the two rival houses. The seeds of the later conflict are really sown right from the beginning, because you cannot, certainly in this era, have one king being so subordinate to another and at his beck and call. And so it proves. The war that my book is focused on starts in 1294, which is several decades after the treaty. But really, I suspect it was unavoidable. It was always going to happen.
It's confusing, isn't it? I mean, with the Plantagenets, that they're so French in a way.
Yeah, they are very French.
They marry into French noble families, and this sort of. You look at it later on as we get into the early modern period, and it's almost a little bit of a joke that we're saying, yeah, we're kings of France, guys, as well as England. But you can see how historically that's so intrinsically linked that it would get a bit confusing.
The Plantagenets are close relatives to the French royal house at this time, the Capets. Edward I's first cousin once removed of his rival, Philip IV. They are physically very similar. They're both described as being sort of tall, flaxen-haired, and temperamentally probably quite similar as well. The Plantagenets are a French-speaking dynasty. I mean, there's some evidence that from the sort of mid-13th century onwards, they speak English sometimes as a sort of second language, but French is still the language of the court until Edward III, really, like another 100 years or so. One of the themes I've wanted to highlight in the book is that this is essentially a kind of fight, a family squabble. It's not a national conflict, which is what it turns into later, between sort of England and France. At this stage, the origins of it, it's two cousins fighting over scraps of territory. And, you know, we shouldn't see it as a sort of racial or ethnic conflict at all.
What do families consistently argue about? Land and inheritance, and also dowries as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what happens. It spirals out of control. And again, as I show in the book, these two kings are so powerful, they are the greatest powers in Western Europe, apart from the Pope. When they go to war, they drag everyone else into their conflict. For a couple of years at least, much of Europe is actually fighting for these two cousins who cannot get along.
So what's the issue with the, I get the land idea, that, you know, they're splitting up France and kind of carving up bits of that amongst the family. What's the issue with the dowries? What's going on there?
Apart from being allowed to retain Gascony via this Paris Agreement in 1259, Henry III also has some outstanding claims to other bits of land which are adjacent to Gascony. And it's quite complicated. So complicated, I've got notes here to remind me of the detail of all this. The problem with sort of understanding all this, again, is the family connections. Henry's claim to these outstanding lands essentially derives from the dowry of his aunt. Ignore that, sorry.
Right.
The dowry of his aunt, Joan of England, who was a daughter of Henry II, also mother of Count Raymond VII of Toulouse, who's another cousin. And then Count Raymond held lands in the Agenais, Quercy, and Saint-Thon, which I'm sure you're very
Of course.
familiar with.
Yeah, very.
Basically, they're adjacent to Gascony in southwest France. So what Henry and his heirs want to do is try and secure these along with Gascony so they can sort of enlarge this territory and make it all look slightly less embarrassing that they've given up everything else. And while these rights are formally recognized by the treaty in 1259, what the kings of France do is basically ignore these sort of these outstanding claims in the subsequent years when Henry tries to basically say to the king of France, hey, remember those other lands? I should have them because it actually says in the treaty that I should have them. The king, Philip III of France, he just ignores him. He doesn't even respond to the petitions. He actually goes off on a tour of France. And it's a sort of grand gesture of contempt, really, because everything about the 1259 agreement is entirely to the advantage of the ruling house of France. It's basically an admission of defeat on Henry's part that his dynasty have lost this very long war. And they're just taking what they can get and what the French kings choose to give them. But then this situation changes when Henry's successor comes to the throne because Edward I is not his father. Everyone learns very quickly that this is a very different character. The Welsh and the Scots particularly, have cause to regret that Edward was ever born. But he's
I'm
but
already
to
thinking of
yeah,
Braveheart.
quite. And he's in a way he's just as forceful in France. He's not willing to let go of these outstanding claims. And to be fair, he's got every right to these lands. It's just the French don't really want to hand them over.
In terms of trying to sort this mess out, then, what does the Peace of Amiens do?
Well, that's the Treaty, Peace of Amiens, treaty in 1279, when Edward has been king for 7 years. It's actually the most sort of advantageous treaty the Plantagenets have managed to cobble together for about a century. Edward has managed to persuade his kinsman, the King of France, Philip III, to hand over some of the outstanding lands. These are specifically the southern part of Saintonge, which is directly north of Gascony. And the Agenais, which is a wide strip of territory to the east, because by gaining these lands, he manages to expand Gascony, which is really a shrunken part of the old Duchy of Aquitaine, which goes all the way back to Roman times. It's basically most of southwest France. And by persuading Philip to let him have these lands, he manages to expand the borders of Gascony almost back to the old frontiers of Aquitaine. And Edward and his dynasty, they always call themselves Dukes of Aquitaine. That's the title they use. They don't call themselves Dukes of Gascony because that's just one part of what they claim. And so via this agreement in 1279, he's quite successful. He manages to persuade Philip to give him back some of the lands, not all of them, but he gets money in exchange. There's another province called Quercy, which Philip isn't willing to hand over, but instead he gives Edward a pension of about 25,000 livres tournois a year, which I think works out at about, at the time, about £10,000 in English sterling, which is a lot of money and it's worth having. And I mean, Edward is not totally uncompromising. He's realistic enough to know that he's not going to like extract everything, and he's quite happy to take the money in lieu. And he also gains, although it's not an official part of the treaty, part of northern France, the county of Ponthieu, which he gains in right of his wife, Eleanor of Castile. It's a small province on the northern banks of the Somme. It's about half the size of Kent, but it's important, far more important politically than it is as a sort of geographic unit, because it means that Edward's got another title. He's now Count of Ponthieu as well as Duke of Aquitaine. And it enables him to keep a team of lawyers at Paris who are there technically to sort of argue over things like fishing rights in Ponthieu and who gets to keep the profits of cutting down the woods and that sort of thing. But in reality, they're there to increase his influence at the French court and in the Paris Parliament. So it's actually it's quite another sort of important gain. And interestingly, it's not part of the main agreement. It's not in the text. It seems to be a sort of private agreement, like he and Philip had a private chat, and Philip went, "All right, you can have that as well." I think from Philip's perspective, all of these lands are being held. Edward would hold them in the under the same sort of subordinate agreement. You're still my vassal, and so, in a way, the more land I give you under that agreement, the more you're acknowledging my sort of supremacy. So I'm happy to do that. And also, it means that I don't have to govern these lands. I don't have to bother with them. You have to do it. All I do is take the money.
Yeah, because I'm guessing there's
Great.
a lot of administration involved in sort of holding land that's not on your doorstep, that is across a narrow sea, but it is still a sea. Yeah, there's a lot involved in policing and maintaining your French properties, and you've got stuff to worry about here, I'm guessing, as well.
I mean, one of the things Edward is able to do is set up a surprisingly sort of efficient administration in Gascony and in Ponthieu. I mean, he's fortunate in that he's got quite a lot of able servants, very sort of capable men on the ground, who are very able to run these lands for him. But on a personal level, he's always very closely engaged. He doesn't govern at one remove. There's all of this surviving correspondence in which he is personally responding to those constant streams of letters from his officers in Gascony and Ponthieu and in Saintonge, because there's so many problems of jurisdiction that arise. One of the big bones of contention is that all of Edward's subjects in France have two overlords.
I was just thinking this. Like, do we know anything about what they made of it? It's like, oh, I've got this bay and I've got another king.
Oh yeah, they made a great deal out of it. It's
Really?
one of the major problems, because the after this agreement in Paris in 1259, the kings of France have got this tremendous advantage. They are Edward's feudal overlord, which means that all of his subjects are their subjects. And so, for instance, if his nobles in Gascony don't like Edward's justice, they go to him with some complaint or go to his officers, the ducal court, and they don't like what they get, they can just go to Paris. They can go over his head and appeal to the King of France. And the kings of France, Philip IV in particular, screw down on this advantage time and time again. They actively encourage Edward's subjects to basically bypass him and come to Paris. And there's this flood of appeals in which they say, well, Edward Seneschal gave my land to my uncle, which is totally unfair because, my uncle's like a villain and I should have it. And the French Parliament is not really concerned with who's got the rightful claim. What they want to do is undermine Edward's authority. So invariably, they will come to the opposite judgment to whatever Edward's officers have said. And they're not even concerned with sort of directly imposing an alternative judgment from France. What they want to do is muddy the waters and ideally keep every sort of legal conflict going for years and years, because it sort of slowly takes apart the English administration. And I have wondered why the French bothered with all of this. Why didn't they just say in 1259, look, we're taking all of it? You're not having Gascony, you're not having anything. We're just going to take all of this, and you can have England, and we don't care about that. Because the conflicts that follow are just as costly from the French or the Capetian Valois perspective as they are from Plantagenets. It's all extremely damaging. And obviously, it's easy to judge in hindsight, but you do sort of wonder perhaps somebody should have piped up in 1259 and said, this isn't going to work. This is awful.
It's true, and Gascony remains the big sticking point, doesn't it? So, in terms of it all kicking off again, who starts it? Who's to blame?
Well, that's a very good question because there are all sorts of charges and accusations flying about at the time. What it boils down to is the French accuse the English of starting it, the English accuse the French of starting it.
It's pretty on brand for us as
Yeah,
a
pretty,
French thing, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
The more sort of interesting story that was very much going about at the time, and I suspect might actually be sort of close to the truth, is that Philip's brother, a chap called Charles of Valois, who actually founds the later royal line of Valois, he's got a personal grudge against Edward because Charles had a claim to the kingdom of Aragon, south of the Pyrenees, and Edward a few years earlier negotiated this deal whereby Charles's claim was sort of cut out. And he acquires this very mocking nickname. He's called Charles Without a Crown, which, you know, doesn't sound particularly funny to us, but was deeply, you know, humiliating to him. One historian said that Charles had had the experience of wearing a crown when he was a child and never got over it. He's sort of kingless after that. He just has to settle for being immensely powerful in France. And the rumour was that he deliberately stirred up a war at sea between English and Norman privateers, between pirates, because this war does, this maritime conflict does blow up out of nowhere, really, in 1293. And it's not a war between the two kingdoms. It's between sort of private fleets. And it seems to start with like a pub brawl. In Gascony, it literally does. Some drunk pirates have a fight in a pub in Bayonne. Yeah. and what seems to happen when you dig really into the sort of fine detail, there's some sailors, English and Norman sailors, in a pub, and one of the Englishmen goes to a well outside because he wants to have a drink of water because he's very drunk. And the Normans stop him. They won't let him go to the well, and they knife him. They just kill him in broad daylight. And this sort of casual violence is, you know, very common amongst pirates. But his comrades pile in, and then the Gascons get involved because they don't like the French and they don't like the Normans. And then this basically erupts. It spreads throughout the town, and then there's sort of copycat killings and fights. And yeah, there are these very interesting rumours going around, admittedly from the English side, basically saying this has all been like set up. It's all been stirred up by Charles in collusion with his elder brother, Philip, because they want to trigger a war to give them an excuse to invade Gascony and Edward's other French lands and basically take them away and make them part of the greater France. And while that is the English version of events, I find it quite believable because everything about the policy in France and the French court at this time, particularly under Philip the Fair, is very aggressive, very expansionist, and not just against the English. Philip and his advisors, they are determined to add Flanders, conquer Flanders, make that part of France, Burgundy, which at the time was part of Holy Roman Empire, big chunks of the Low Countries. They've got this sort of vision of this grand imperial France, and it's, you know, it's completely within their sort of capacity to be trying to stir up a war via all this cloak and dagger stuff and egging on Norman pirates to do nasty things.
This feels very familiar as early modern, spending a lot of time with Louis XIV. This does feel
right.
Like,
yes,
it feels like tactics.
Yeah.
This does feel like, you know, a brilliant way of expanding your territory, get your enemies to fight each other, and enjoy the spoils, help yourself. But I love this idea of having private fleets just going to battle as a fan of boaty war.
It's great. There's at least two like major battles fought at sea between these rival fleets that aren't talked about very much, I think, because they're not part of this the war that then happens between England and France. They're privateers, they're private firms, but the problem is that they're made up of, on the one side, Normans, who are vassals of Normandy, is now part of France, and on the other side they're made up of English, Irish and Gascons, who are all Edward's subjects. So although it's a private war, inevitably it's going to come to the attention of the kings, and they're going to have to do something about it because they can't just let it's disrupting trade, particularly the wine trade from Gascony, which generates a lot of money in England. So they can't let it carry on. And that's when it all starts to sort of spiral into a wider conflict.
So we're at war on sea. There's a separate thing happening on the land. I believe. Is that right? There's the sort of the this is the preamble. Then it goes to a land-based war.
Yeah.
Philip tries to take Gascony back.
Yeah, and what Philip does, he doesn't just declare war. There isn't a sort of a direct line of violence between the privateer war at sea and then suddenly war between England and France. What he does is summon Edward to Paris to explain and basically apologise for the behaviour of his pirates, of his privateers, which is he's got to be very galling for Edward because as far as he's concerned, his men didn't start it. But Philip quite cleverly, when he summons Edward as his vassal to Paris to do this, which he's got technically every right to do, he doesn't issue a safe conduct, which is the important thing, because without it, Edward has no guarantee of his safety. Without a safe conduct, he could go to Paris and be arrested, thrown into prison. Now, he's the King of England, you know, he's not going to take that risk. And again, this is, I think, a detail that gets overlooked a little bit. You know, the devil is in the detail. When Philip refuses or fails to issue a safe conduct, that is basically saying, I want a war, and this is how I'm going to provoke it. Because Edward's response is to renounce his homage. He tears up the vassal arrangement, says, I'm no longer your vassal. And then it forces him to declare war. So Philip can then point to Edward and say, well, he started it. When in fact, what Philip's done is manipulate the entire situation. And then, even then, you have this complex round of diplomacy that goes back and forth. Again, there's no sort of outright spiral into a, like an open war situation. But Philip, again, he very cleverly manipulates everything. Edward sends his brother Edmund over to Paris to try and patch this all up.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This localized fighting has already started in Gascony. And while there's not like a full-scale invasion, there's quite a lot of disruption and violence going on. And Edmund's job is to try and just patch things up. Because even at this stage, the English don't, or the Plantagenets don't suspect what Philip is up to. And Philip says, OK, look, fine, what we'll do to save face all round is if you give up, technically, certain key towns and fortresses in Gascony to my men, like Bordeaux, for instance, which is the main city, and we'll keep them for 40 days, like a grace period of 40 days. And at the end of that, we'll give them back, and then I'll announce to my parliament that honour is satisfied. Edward, this is basically Edward's apology. He's, you know, given up his territory temporarily to me as his overlord, and then I'll give it all back and it'll all be fine and there'll be no war. Which sounds on the face of it like, what, are you kidding? You know, are you insane? I'm not going to do that. But Edmund is desperate to take any sort of deal. And what Philip does is he only moves very small groups of French officers into each of these sort of towns. They're like just a token presence. I think he sends 6 men to Bordeaux. Well, that's okay. You know, 6 men aren't going to make much difference. But then he deliberately prolongs the negotiations. And as they drag out, he feeds more and more troops onto the French strongholds on the borders of Gascony. And he sends his chief advisor, this very interesting spy master called Pierre Float. He's a lawyer from the University of Paris, and he's the one who's got all these wonderful new ideas about imperialism and expansionism and why France should rule the world. And he organizes this sort of slow funneling of armed men, of soldiers and garrisons into Gascony until the French are in a position where they can just move in and take all of these places and occupy the duchy. And they can do it bloodlessly because the English are in no position to defend the place. And that's exactly what happens. Edmund is stonewalled. By this point, he's desperately, like literally banging on Philip's door going, please talk to me, what on earth is going on? And eventually Philip sends out two bishops. He won't even talk to Edmund directly. And they curtly inform him that, no, Gascony's ours now. There's no comeback. We don't want to talk to you anymore. Go home. And he has to slope off home back to England and tell Edward what's happened. And it's probably the only moment in Edward's career where he actually looks humiliated in public. He actually goes very red because he realises what he's done. He's surrendered Gascony without a fight. And it's completely humiliating. And his nobles, when they hear what he's done, they're absolutely enraged. It's like, what's this? You've given up the last of, you know, your continental inheritance without a fight, and you've allowed yourself to be completely outmaneuvered by Philip. So, and then that's the start of, because the only way the English can get it back is through force. So that's when the real war starts.
I'd love to have been in the room when Edmund told him what had happened.
Yeah, can you imagine? And he actually writes out this written apology, which survives, and it's very grovelling. Because I mean, Edward is probably the older brother from hell anyway, and you've got to go and tell him what you've just done. And this sort of plea that he submits in writing is like, it's all my fault, please let me redeem myself and don't do horrible things to me. So,
oh my goodness.
I think if people are, because sometimes this is so far removed, I know for me, I just feel like this is like 1,000 years ago. I have no idea what's going on. But this, if you have seen Braveheart, I don't know much about this period, but it sounds like the portrayal of the King of England in that is quite on brand. He's got the best one-liners in the film, hasn't he? But he's ruthless in that film. I mean, what's the quote about the trouble is with Scotland is that it's full of Scots, which always makes me cackle because obviously I'm English. Is it fair if we would say to people, watch Braveheart and you get some idea of the personality of this man?
I think you get an idea of one facet of Edward's
obviously with no historical accuracy about what he's actually doing.
Well, no, quite. I mean, I think there's that famous moment where he throws his son's lover out the window.
Is it the bit about prima nocte? Is that true?
Oh God, no. I don't hate Braveheart. It's quite entertaining for what it is.
Yeah.
But things like claiming that Edward instituted a form of mass rape in Scotland, I mean, that's just provocative.
Yeah. I think we have got a whole episode that is entitled Why Braveheart is Rubbish with Ryan McNutt literally ripping it to shreds for the historical accuracy. So,
I mean, in terms of how it presents Edward, I mean, I think a lot of people at the time would certainly have perceived him in that way. Mm. This sort of emotionally shut off. The actor who plays him, Patrick McGoohan, is very imposing. He's the right person for the role. But Edward is a very complicated person. He never loses, despite whatever mistakes he might make, he never loses the loyalty of his sort of key followers. He's one of the very few medieval kings of England who never has to fight a civil war, which is important. I think the film gets across his sort of physical presence. But the way he talks to his underlings in this sort of obey me or else, I think it's a bit more subtle than that, because a lot of his followers, like his earls, they were just as kind of like forceful. And I mean, we're talking about people who had the absolute power of life and death over their vassals, their subjects. And I don't think, although Edward was perhaps an unusually sort of determined and forceful personality, I don't think he would have got very far just by trying to intimidate everyone around him, because they would have just laughed at him. they were equally intimidating.
Yeah.
But, I should imagine, you know, quite a lot of people who ended up on the wrong end of his sort of temper would have perceived him much as how he's portrayed in Braveheart. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, should we go back to France, Charlie?
Yeah, let's go.
That's several years after this, isn't it? So let's go back.
We will talk about Braveheart until we're blue in the face, I'm sure. Do you like that?
Yeah. Although he wouldn't have been blue in the face or had a sword. So
I knew you'd like that. So look, any medieval king has to be a warrior king in many ways, has to be a leader of men. So let's talk about Edward's forces. How did the fortunes of war affect his forces when they're fighting in, what was it? We're in 96, 97 now, as in 12.
Yeah, 1296. Yeah. Well, at this point, from 1296, Edward finds himself at war on several fronts. He's fighting the Scots from 1296, and he's also committed huge financial and military obligations to this network of allies he's constructed to fight the French on the continent. But he also wants to recover Gascony. And so he's got to fight, or thinks he's got to fight, on at least three fronts, in Scotland, Gascony, and Flanders, which is the other end of Northern Europe.
Yeah.
And while at the same time holding down Wales and Ireland. I mean, Wales has only been recently reconquered. Ireland is in a perpetual state of sort of low-key warfare, and the only way the Plantagenets can retain any sort of control is by this permanent military presence. So he's seriously overstretched, and in 1296 he takes the bulk of his army, the feudal host of England, into Scotland, and he wins this very sort of crushing victory, albeit temporary, over the Scots. But while that's happening, at exactly the same time, he sends another army over to Gascony, a sort of expeditionary force, much smaller than the army in Scotland, because he's only got so many men. And their job really is to try and hold off the French for as long as possible until Edward can get over there with the majority of his army, which it was the sort of different perspective I wanted to put on things in the book, because the usual thing with Edward I is to concentrate on Scotland and Wales, this whole sort of hammer of the Scots image. The whole point of what he does in Scotland in 1296 is that he's in a hurry. He doesn't want to be in Scotland. And the reason this campaign that he leads there is like this sort of very brutal lightning blitzkrieg, it's over in a matter of weeks, is because he doesn't want to be there. He wants to turn around very quickly, race down to the south coast of England and get over to Gascony, because he's already 2 years late on doing that. He was meant to sail in 1294, and his allies, who have been very expensively assembled, they've been waiting for him for 2 years. And in the event, they will wait for him for another year. 3 years will go by before he's actually able to get over to the continent. And all the while, it's this massive drain on the English treasury, because he has to hire these allies. They're all contractors, and they gobble up enormous amounts of English money. They're not cheap. So, yeah, that's the situation.
Yeah, so that's crazy. I mean, it's almost like, do you want to be a really good idea if you really want to get the English? Scotland and France, they should have some kind of alliance.
Yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it? Yeah, that's this period is the origin of the old alliance.
That's what'll come out of this. So Edward's sorted out Scotland as far as he's concerned.
Well, he thinks he has.
Brutally.
He has. Yeah.
And he's running over, and the idea is a two-pronged attack on Gascony and Flanders.
Mm.
So two forces going after, and they're in completely separate directions.
Well, that's the idea.
How does that end up?
Well, the problem is, by this time, there's this sort of disconnect between what the King of England wants to do on the continent and what the nobles of England want to do, because the majority of them have long since lost their ancestral lands in France. They lost them in King John's time, and Henry III failed to get anything back. And the only land that England still holds in France is held by the king. So they have no vested interest in fighting in Gascony, let alone Flanders, except at the king's wages, except for what he can pay them. And when Edward announces this strategy, this two-pronged strategy in Parliament, his earls famously just flatly refuse. The Earl of Norfolk and the Earl of Hereford, they say, we're not going. because he wants them to lead the army in Gascony while he takes another part of the army to Flanders. And they just say, no, we're not going to go. And everybody's completely unused to being defied in this way in public. And he loses his temper and he famously says to the Earl of Norfolk, by God, sir, oh, you will go, you will hang. And he replies with, by God, sir, king, I'll either go nor I hang. And then he strides out. and there's not a lot. I mean, Edward will get in later. Edward is not one to forget a slight, and he absolutely nails the Earl of Norfolk a few years later. But at this stage, he just has to swallow it. And again, it's very humiliating. And it means he has to change his strategy. He has to abandon this idea that he can wage war on three fronts at once. The other problem is that he's got to find the men from somewhere. And he's levying enormous crippling taxes to pay for all these wars on England. And his English subjects are starting to sort of really protest and say, when is this going to end? You've already conquered Wales, and now you're fighting the Scots, and now you're fighting the French. Endless war taxes, and not just money, he's also demanding food to feed his soldiers, which is leaving a lot of people where they've got nothing to eat, because like the king's knights keep coming and taking everything. So he's got serious problems. He's seriously overstretched in this sort of 1296-97 period. And to make things worse, the French war is going rather badly, which is not surprising, really, because his men in Gascony are completely outnumbered. And his allies in Flanders are isolated. And the French are seriously powerful. They are the sort of like military power in Europe at this time.
So, it's fascinating, isn't
looking
it?
Looking quite grim.
It's like if you're looking for a medieval figure that might be able to come in an adult at this point, the Pope, perhaps. Does the Pope come in and attempt to say, right, you two, separate now, either side of the room, get your shit together?
Yeah, he does. He does. Yeah. The problem is that the Pope at the time, Boniface VIII, who's probably one of the most eccentric men who ever sort of sit, and there's been a few, to sit on the papal throne. I have mixed sort of opinions on Boniface because he genuinely wants the kings to stop fighting. He wants peace between England and France. But he does it in this very sort of eccentric way. I mean, he sends some letters to Edward that, while they're well-intentioned, he's trying to persuade Edward to stop fighting the French and that everything, you know, let's have peace, it'll be lovely. But inadvertently, he manages to insult Edward by referring to Gascony as this really sort of worthless, inadequate bit of land that nobody should be fighting over. And it's one of Edward's most prized possessions. I mean, he spent long periods of his youth there. He spent 20 years cultivating it and making it rich. And here's the Pope telling him that it's worthless. Forget about it. And at the same time, Boniface engages in a war of words with Philip, which is far worse. I mean, they start sending each other personal insults. And it gets quite entertaining. Philip starts referring in his official letters, he stops referring to the Pope as your grace or your divinity, the usual titles. Instead, he calls him your divine fatuity, or your divine idiot, basically calling him a moron. And this spirals out of control eventually, and Philip basically turns on the Pope and sends his agents to actually physically assault him on the steps of his own palace, which is unprecedented. I mean, plenty of kings have argued with popes in the past, but to actually send your hired goons to beat him up was something new. So to get back to your question, Boniface, he does step in to try and stop the war, and he succeeds up to a point, but he doesn't really do it to anyone's satisfaction. Nobody's sort of happy with what are the terms, what he comes up with. It's all a bit of a bodge.
Do they go along with it, though? I mean, does he actually succeed in getting the peace?
Well, to an extent. The deal he offers is, look, Edward, if you agree to marry one of Philip's daughters, and then your son, the future Edward II, can marry another daughter, then there'll be a marriage alliance between the two houses, and that will seal the peace. And in the meantime, I'll try and persuade Philip to get his hands off Gascony. and let you have it back. And Edward's sort of willing to go along with this up to a point. I mean, he attempts to say to the Pope, hang on, why don't we cut another deal, right? How about you get me Gascony back, and then I'll hand it over to you as a papal fief. So I'll now hold it from the Pope, from Rome, instead of the King of France. So, I mean, that would be ideal from Edward's point of view, because it means he no longer has any obligations to the French. But Boniface, although he might sort of like that idea, he points out, we have these wonderful transcripts of, he says to the English envoys, the problem is, lads, in the Philip of the power of King of France. And I think he's very aware that Philip is a very different proposition to previous French kings. There isn't really anything he won't do. He'll go to any sort of extreme. And then he had another wonderful quote. He says to Edward's envoys, look, my sons, to deal with the French is to deal with the devil. Basically saying, you can't do anything with them. This is the best you're going to get. But then Boniface finally announces his award, his sort of peace deal, the French don't like it either. And when the document is actually presented at the French court, Philip's brother, Charles of Valois, who I mentioned earlier, he looks at it and then rips it up, throws it in the fire, and then jumps up and down on it. He's like a spoiled child. He's actually jumping up and down on the bits of this parchment because he can't get what he wants. It's extraordinary. These sort of overgrown children, really.
God, who kept Flanders? Did Flanders stay with the... Is that the Holy Roman Empire still?
No. Flanders is ruled by Count Guy Dampierre, who's one of, when the war is in progress, Count Guy is one of the first men who Edward enlists into his so-called Grand Alliance against the French. And Guy has done the same thing as Edward. He was a vassal of the King of France, but Philip treated him, knocked him about just as badly. So he has done the same as Edward. He renounced his homage and declared war on France. And then he and Edward teamed up. But what Boniface does, in order to secure peace between England and France, he's quite prepared to sacrifice everyone else, the lesser lights. And the chief sort of victim in all this is Guy, unfortunately. And when the peace talks are held at Rome in 1298, Edward's envoys, to be fair to them, they actually try and appeal to the Pope and say, will you let Guy of Flanders and the Flemings be included in the final peace? So they do actually try and, you know, they don't just abandon their allies. And Boniface actually gets quite angry. He stands up and he says, I'm not going to do anything for Guy of Flanders alone. And then he sort of wags his finger and says, and if Guy doesn't like my terms, he doesn't like my peace agreement, well, he can go jump off a cliff, basically. He can go and find help elsewhere, which is a very, very cold, cruel thing to say, really, because Boniface is perfectly aware that Guy hasn't got anywhere else to go. And when he's cut adrift by the Pope, all he can do is send these begging letters to Edward, which are quite pitiful, really. They survive, in which he pleads with him not to make peace with France and to hold to the original alliance with Flanders, which is no longer in Edward's interest. You know, this is all very pragmatic. And Guy is not doing himself any favours. I mean, the tone of these letters is so pitiful. He's sounding utterly sort of beaten and pathetic. And all Edward does in response, he says, well, I might ask the Pope to help, but it's not really anything to do with me anymore. Sorry. Poor old Guy is cut loose and left isolated.
Why don't people remember this war?
I think it's overshadowed by the later sort of Anglo-French conflicts because of several reasons. They're much more straightforward to understand. The later wars, because they're sort of perceived as a sort of clash of nations, England v France, and then you have all the famous battles, the Longbow. There's a certain glamour to all that, Agincourt, Henry V, the Shakespeare play, you know, and then the Black Prince a bit earlier. Whereas this war, it's a sort of complex, dirty fight over sovereignty between two French-speaking kings. Can't really be shown as a sort of straightforward national conflict. There's not really many great battles, or at least not in in Gascony. And it's a sort of very, it's like a grinding affair in which both kings just have to pump money and resources into it until they come to this sort of stalemate. The problem is they can't, one, that they cancel each other out. They can't, unless they risk a battle, a big battle, which they don't want to do. Then there can be no resolution except sort of if they start talking. So it's not very glamorous, not very glorious.
No, I think this is the problem, isn't it? We like wars where we can say we absolutely won.
We hammered those guys.
We were definitely the good guys.
Yeah.
Didn't start it, weren't causing any trouble, and absolutely won. So it's probably far too complicated to be a quick and easy documentary on a terrestrial TV channel. So I think everyone's going to have to read your book, David. Thank you so much for joining us. You have to get a copy of this, guys. Edward Longshanks, Forgotten Conflict, the Anglo-French War. It's hugely interesting and so many future echoes in there, aren't there?
Yes. And when I was writing it, what it put me in mind of was sort of later 18th century conflicts between these great powers, but they're behaving in exactly the same way in the late 13th century, which is interesting.
There you go. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.